In 1934, after several seasons of saying he wouldn't go, Babe Ruth traveled to Japan. He was accompanied by lots of other Major League ballplayers and by Connie Mack, who managed the Philadelphia Athletics for 50 years. Ruth, with his home runs, was the star of the traveling show, but when Robert Fitz began researching the trip, he found lots of other reasons to write about it. That's why his book, Banzai Babe Ruth, is subtitled Baseball, Espionage, and Assassination during the 1934 Tour of Japan. The author joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Robert Fitz, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks very much. I'm very pleased to be here.
There was a general sense among the U.S. ballplayers, and it was a sense shared by the U.S. ambassador to Japan, that the trip would have a beneficial effect on relations between the U.S. and Japan. What was the state of that relationship in 1934?
The United States and Japan were on the road to war, even in the early 30s. Both were rivals in the Pacific, both wanted to have the strongest navies in the Pacific, and both were rivals in China. Both wanted to control the trade in the country. So Japan was expanding, as was the United States around the Pacific Rim, and they were in a collision course.
Major League Baseball players had toured Japan before 1934, but they'd never had Babe Ruth along for the ride. How did his presence affect the adventure?
Babe Ruth, of course, is the god of baseball, and he was no less the god in Japan. Everybody knew who he was. You didn't have to be a baseball fan to know who Babe Ruth was. So he was the entire focus of the tour. I mean, it's true, the team had Lou Gehrig, the team had Jimmy Fox, Connie Mack, and these players were well known in Japan, but it was really all about Babe Ruth.
Well, before the players reached Japan, the shenanigans began, or at least they may have. Tell us the story of Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig's wife, Eleanor, a mountain of caviar, and an ocean of champagne.
Well, as everybody probably knows, Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth had a falling out. There were many stories about why this occurred, as the most popular story was that Lou Gehrig's mother made certain comments about why Babe Ruth's natural daughter was always poorly dressed when his stepdaughter was well-dressed. But there's another rumor going around, and the rumor was that on the way over, Babe Ruth and Eleanor Gehrig may have had a quick affair. And the evidence, it was a rumor. I had never seen it in print before, but in Eleanor Gehrig's autobiography, she tells this story about how she went down with Claire Ruth, Babe's wife, to apologize for the falling out with the family. And Eleanor does talk a little bit about this misunderstanding over how the Ruth daughters were dressed. Mm-hmm. And then she says the Babe was in his suite surrounded by a mound of caviar and drinking champagne. Eleanor Gehrig, you have to remember, grew up in affluence. She was used to being surrounded by the finer things in life, but her family lost most of their money in the Depression. And then she married a ball player at a time where ball players didn't make as much money as they do today. So she supposedly couldn't resist the caviar and the champagne and sat down with the Babe and spent 2 hours in there. Well, Gehrig was upstairs on the top of the ship looking for her, and he was frantic. He's like, where could his new bride, they're on their honeymoon, have gone? And he actually organized a search party, and they searched the ship from top to bottom, and he concluded she fell overboard. So he wanted the ship to circle around and start looking for her in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. When all of a sudden she shows up, apparently she must have been kind of tipsy as well, and Lou Gehrig just went ice cold, apparently. He just glared at her and walked away and didn't speak to her for several days. Lou, I guess, feared the worst.
Once the actual baseball games were underway, it became apparent that the Japanese teams were incapable of providing much in the way of competition. The major leaguers went undefeated. Did that matter?
Not so much. The Japanese players and the American players knew that the Americans were there to teach the finer points of the game and to provide excitement for the fans because the Japanese were about to start their professional league. They needed the fans to get ready to embrace professional baseball. There was even a sense that professionalism sullied the sport, and that the true sport needed to remain amateur. So by watching Gehrig and Ruth and Fox, the idea was to show how well they can conduct themselves, and therefore Japan could also embrace professional baseball. Prior to going over there, the Commissioner of Baseball, Judge Landis, sent an open letter to the team emphasizing they were ambassadors for the United States and ambassadors for Major League Baseball, and that unlike previous tours, the players were supposed to behave themselves, and they would take it very seriously if they misbehave. By all accounts, they did behave themselves.
Except for on the trip over.
Perhaps. But that, they weren't in Japan at that point, so it was all right.
Was there any evidence that the 1934 trip did improve relations between the two countries?
They certainly did temporarily. If you go back and look at the newspapers from 1934, almost every story about Japan in the American press is negative. The Japanese army had invaded Manchuria in 1931. They're in the process of leaving the League of Nations. All the press was negative to Japan. But for 1 month, the month of November 1934, just about every story was positive. They talked about how wonderful the Japanese fans were, how they embraced baseball. And there was a real naive feeling back then that if a country could embrace baseball, they could embrace democracy as well. They believed baseball taught fair play. And thus, if you could play fairly on the diamond, you can learn to play fairly in the international sphere as well.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941, Babe Ruth took it personally. Describe his reaction to the news.
Well, first, you have to understand that Babe Ruth loved the press and he believed the press. So when the reporters were writing in December of 1934 that Babe Ruth had forestalled any possible conflict between the United States and Japan because of baseball, he really took it to heart. And he felt very close to the Japanese people. He loved this trip to Japan. So apparently he started running around his apartment on Riverside Drive in Manhattan, grabbing up Japanese souvenirs who his wife Claire had decorated the living room with, pulled open the window, and tossed them out of his apartment onto Riverside Drive below, shattering vases, dolls. And Claire's running around in front of him, you know, looking to see where he's going to look next. And his eyes go to the mantelpiece. So she runs to the mantelpiece and grabs all she can before he runs over and grabs what's left and tosses it. And luckily, Claire was a very intelligent woman. She grabbed all the good stuff. But a lot of the tchotchkes, you know, that were decorating this apartment were completely destroyed and left on the street.
Is there any record of whether Babe Ruth ever moved beyond the sense of personal betrayal he felt on December 7th, 1941?
There's not a strong record of that. He remained very popular in Japan after the war. It's very usual to see magazine covers with Babe Ruth on the covers in 48 and around his death. And after he died, the Japanese participated in Babe Ruth Day, which was a American Major League Baseball, let's call it a holiday, to honor Ruth. So although I don't have any statements from Ruth saying anything like, I forgive the Japanese, or it's time to come together, or anything like that, the Japanese once again embraced him after World War II.
Various sources, including the Sporting News, concluded shortly after Pearl Harbor that, quote, the Japanese did not even deserve to play baseball. What was their reasoning there exactly?
That's correct. That goes back to what I mentioned earlier. There was this belief within baseball circles that baseball had almost supernatural powers, that by playing baseball you learn fair play, you can learn democracy. It was a gift. It was the American national game, and there was something special about it. So the idea that Japan could do something underhanded like Pearl Harbor was against the fair play on the baseball diamond. So that's where they're coming from.
No, it seems extraordinary to me that very shortly after the end of the Second World War, U.S. ballplayers were once again touring Japan. Tell us a little about how that happened and what it accomplished.
Very few non-baseball fanatics know of a fellow named Lefty O'Doul. He was a several-time batting champ in the late 1920s, 1930s, and he helped organize the 1934 tour. He was the major league player who worked with the Yomiuri newspaper from Tokyo to help bring the players over there. During the 31 and 34 tour, O'Doul formed a friendship with a Japanese man named Satoru Suzuki. As soon as the war was over, 1946, O'Doul bought a ticket to Japan with his own money and went straight over to Tokyo to look for his old friends. And then he sat down with Suzuki and said, "How can we bring baseball back as soon as possible?" Their belief was that Japan needed baseball to help build morale, and on top of that, it could help mend ties between the two countries. Luckily enough, MacArthur was also a baseball fan, and O'Doul brought over the San Francisco Seals. He was at that point manager, 1949, the San Francisco Seals, and it was another great success. Hundreds of thousands of people came out to watch the Seals and to cheer them. A number of sources, not just baseball writers, but even newspaper writers, said this tour of the Seals perhaps did more to heal a lot of the wounds of the war than any other single action.
Robert Fitz is the author of Banzai Babe Ruth, Baseball, Espionage, and Assassination During the 1934 Tour of Japan. The book is published by the University of Nebraska Press, and the author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Robert, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Great, thanks very much.
Uncle Sam, when you play ball, the rules must all be fair. Your name is in a golden frame for playing on the square. Uncle Sam, we've made a vow since that Pearl Harbor raid, and now it's up to you to show them how the game is played. You're gonna win that ball game, Uncle Sam, so pitch that cannonball the way you can. You are slow beginning, but just wait till that ninth inning. You can finish.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like pizza from Italy and cheddar from Australia. Locations at TraderJoe's.com. This is NPR.